welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour discussing the media fighting fake news. We're joined by Dr. Rob Williams of the Action Coalition of Media Education to discuss critical media literacy in an age of digital disorientation. We'll also speak with journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and Media Roots about media propaganda. We'll hear dispatches from her recent trip to Venezuela. We'll also hear from Project Censored's Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about our newest book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, just out on Seven Stories Press. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour doing what we oft do here at the Project Censored Show, looking at the media. Today, we're going to be talking about fighting fake news in an age of digital disorientation. We're joined first by Dr. Rob Williams. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. He is the author of the recent book, Most Likely to Secede, What the Vermont Independence Movement Can Teach Us About Reclaiming Community and Creating a Human-Scale Vision for the 21st Century. He's also co-editor with Julie Frechette of Media Education for a Digital Generation. Additionally, Rob Williams is a contributor to Project Censored and also on the board of our collective efforts at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. You can learn more at gcml.org. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
So good to be with you and Peter, Mickey.
It's fantastic to have you on, as always, Rob. And as usual, our planets align. We talk about off-air about some things that you've been working on that directly correlate to what Andy Lee Roth and I have been working on in the next Project Censored book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. And you've been working on an article called Fighting Fake News in an Age of Digital Disorientation, Towards Real News, Critical Media Literacy Education, and Independent Journalism for the 21st Century Citizens. And again, couldn't have more of a crossover with what we're all doing here. So, Rob, let's just kick it off and talk about, you know, where are you going with this piece and how does this dovetail with your work of late?
Really, the goal is to marry critical media literacy education, which we've been doing for a long time at ACME, with independent journalism, which, of course, dovetails beautifully with the work that Project Censored and GCMLP have been doing for a long time, particularly Project Censored. And we've been reviving Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's five-filter propaganda model of news, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, really charted in their book Manufacturing Consent back in the, I think it was 1987 when the book first came out, 1988. And in that book, of course, in the propaganda model of news, Chomsky and Herman posited a five-filter model through which all news and information has to pass in the U.S. so-called news and information culture before it saw the light of day, before it made its way to readers and viewers and what have you. And what's so fascinating now, of course, living in the digital age, or the age of digital disorientation, is the challenge of sort of updating that filter-driven propaganda model of news for the digital age. And what I proposed in this book chapter that we're working on right now and in some of the work we're doing at Vermont Independent and here at the University of Vermont in Burlington is updating this filter model. And we've added five filters for the digital age.
Let's talk about that in a moment. You start, of course, you know, George Seldes' great quote, journalism's job is not impartial, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is to tell the people what's really going on. Yeah. And when you're talking about adding to the list in our upcoming book here, Censored 2018, Edward Herman contributed a chapter on the propaganda model. And so, again, great dovetailing and symbiotic work going on here. And before we get into the additional filters and things that you're talking about, what do you mean by age of digital disorientation?
It's probably best captured in something a bewildered reporter said early in the year, right after Inauguration Day, in response to yet another sort of tweet storm from Donald Trump. He said, "What does Donald Trump mean when he uses words? What does Donald Trump mean when he says words?" And I just thought that was like the funniest and most telling sort of journalistic moment of the year so far.
Not only post-truth president, but postmodern.
Like, we're so far down kind of the postmodern rabbit hole in the, as encapsulated by this one sentence, that words themselves have lost all sort of ability to anchor us in a shared reality. And there's a big argument, I think, to be made that that's exactly how sort of creeping fascism, totalitarianism work. It's about unmooring people and putting them off balance, about disorienting people, regardless of their party or their politics or what have you, keeping people in sort of a perpetual state of disorientation. I think that's what we're witnessing right now. And everyone here in Vermont is really kind of scratching their head going, what? What is going on? Where are our anchors to a common reality?
It's as if we're in the eye of the Twitter storm. It's like scandal fatigue. Every time one turns around, I mean, and it's as if the media has been dragged and sucked into the morass that they helped create in the first place.
That's exactly right. And I think we're all in agreement that Trump is a symptom of a much larger, deeper, and older historical problem, which is this problem of how power is exercised in a heavily mediated age by corporations and governments who use these kinds of disorienting propagandistic moves to keep everybody off balance and keep everybody from organizing.
Well, indeed, in an era of fake news, alternative facts, post-truth, I mean, again, this has sort of been the riff and the theme that we've been dealing with here all year on several talks. We'll get into that here momentarily. Peter?
It seems that we're reaching this era, and certainly digital media contributes to that, where people are so used to simply entertainment, all news becomes hyper-real, and that people just don't know what to believe anymore, and almost, in fact, can't have a reality because of the contradictions. You know, I mean, during the campaign, it was Hillary's progressive, which is a huge contradiction, or we have to go to war with Russia, or Venezuela's a dictatorship. All of these are lies. You know, or North Korea is ready to destroy San Francisco. These are lies, but because there's so much of this propaganda inside of corporate media and digital media today, you don't know what's real anymore.
I think that's right, Peter, and I think it's really the perfect marriage of the Huxleyan warning that we are amusing ourselves to death, as Neil Postman famously said, a kind of the marriage of the Huxleyan warning with the Orwellian warning, which is the power of Big Brother with a capital B and a capital B in the form of state-driven or deep state-driven propaganda to completely disorient people. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It's not an either-or phenomenon. It's a both-and, a Huxley and Orwell combined kind of crazy disorienting phenomenon.
Indeed, and it keeps coming up over and over again. And you know, going back to such classic works like you mentioned, whether it's Huxley, Orwell, Postman, or in between even Orwell in terms of the politics of the English language, extraordinary reliance on euphemisms. And now it's in terms of that reality, we know about euphemisms and George Carlin's rants on that. But now we've gone even further, jumped the shark to alternative facts. It's beyond confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is where we go out and look for something that's factual that supports our view only. But now we live in a culture where from the top down, it's being modeled that you can manufacture material or evidence, or my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge and facts. That is extraordinarily destructive to any democratic culture. And you and I also agree, I'm sure, on this point, because this is one of our mainstays, certainly through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, through ACME, Project Censored. And that's the importance of critical media literacy education is the antidote to the onslaught of fake news and alternative facts in a post-truth world.
That's exactly right, Mickey.
So talk to us about that, Rob Williams, University of Vermont. Talk to us about more of the critical media literacy education component, particularly as you're outlining in your chapter with your additional filters.
We're really in the business, I think, of providing citizens with kind of three broad arenas, if you will. One is greater knowledge, and I think historical knowledge is deeply lacking. I would start there. Second would be skills, the kinds of skills of access, of media analysis, of media evaluation, of media criticism, media production in the digital age to really combat this digital disorientation. And then thirdly would be an activist sensibility, or if the term activist is too radical for some, a sense of civic engagement, that we want citizens to be involved in projects larger than themselves designed to make their worlds a better place for more people and the planet. So it's really about knowledge, number one, skills, number two, and activism, number three. And everything that we do, I think, in critical media literacy circles drives towards those three overlapping goals. The other thing to say about critical media literacy education is that we're fiercely independent when it comes to our funding and the networks that we build. A lot of media education in the United States and globally is, shall we say, massaged by corporations and governments who have, of course, their own agendas.
Back to the propaganda model.
Well, that's right. We're trying to carve out an independent space separate from government, separate from corporations, where we can cultivate this sensibility, this critical media literacy sensibility, with people of all ages, not just students and universities, colleges, K through 12 schools, but also, I think, thinking adults who are as bewildered and disoriented by a lot of this stuff as our young people are.
Rob, you used the word global, and I'd like to pick up on that, because we really are talking about global media today. And I'm referring to Lee Art's book, The Global Entertainment Media, where he looks at MSNBC and CBS and ABC and those. They're all transnational. Disney is 150 countries. This is a global media project now. In many cases, it's coming from transnational capital. That is, it's not just the U.S. anymore. It is a global capitalist project to protect capitalism and to protect the privacy of corporations and the military in their adventures to allow capital flow anywhere in the world. That's the entertainment model of where we are today. So all of this power concentrated in less than, you know, 0.001% of the world's population, the multi-billionaires and millionaires, and that's what corporate media is today. It's owned and run by these mega wealthy people using those filters to control us and get us to behave and to consume and to believe in the rightfulness of capitalism to be anywhere in the world. It's totally a controlling, entertaining media.
That's right, Peter. And you've done some pioneering work on the transnational capitalist class. And I think part of our job in the critical media literacy education arena, a big part of it, is to connect the dots between what you just talked about with the transnational capitalist class and the way in which that particular group of people, that network of people, massage our so-called news, information, and entertainment digital media platforms for maximum messaging benefit to them. I think that's absolutely right.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Dr. Rob Williams, University of Vermont, on the board at the Action Coalition for Media Education, as well as the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. Rob is co-editor most recently of a book called Media Education for a Digital Generation, co-edited with another friend of ours, Julie Frechette. And Rob, let's go into defining some of these other terms that you're getting at in the piece that you're working on, In an Age of Digital Disorientation. Before we get into fake news, let's define real news.
There's a big conversation about what constitutes real news. But for me, real news has six key simple characteristics. Number one, it's recent. Number two, it's relevant, by which we mean to say it's much talked about in the culture. Number three, it's reliable, which means you can tap into the sources from which that story comes from and recognize their authenticity and their accuracy. Number four, real news is about foregrounding power relations, what some call hegemony or hegemonic relations. Real news also, I think, has multiple points of view. And finally, real news is about historicizing the story. So much of what we get, what passes for news, quote unquote, in our culture right now is completely devoid of any sort of historical or hegemonic context. What the great writer, he worked out your way in California, Wallace Stegner, for many decades, called the amputated present. So much of our news is kind of trapped in the amputated present. It has no connection to the past. It has no connection really to the future. It kind of washes over us, and then, you know, we're on to the next story. So those are the six ingredients that, in our mind, comprise real news.
Well, Rob Williams, fellow history professor here as well, I teach a whole critical reasoning course that looks at the intersection of past and present as a roadmap for the future and looks at the propaganda of historical construction, which deals directly with looking at propaganda model and filters and these very definitions that we're getting at. So now let's talk about the phenomenon of fake news. There's many definitions. You know, a decade ago, fake news was a satire like Stephen Colbert. But fake news as literally manufactured false information and propaganda is very old. And the current iteration of fake news is it's been weaponized to allow people to dismiss things with which they disagree. Talk to us a little bit about how you see fake news.
The term fake news is used in a bunch of different ways. One is to dismiss any argument or counterargument that you or your party or your group of people or your stakeholder simply don't agree with. Fake news can also be used to demonize an entire network or channel or platform, which I think is incredibly dangerous, actually. And when I talk with my students about this phenomenon, I said, look, some of you grow up in a culture where you think everything on Fox News is complete and utter others of you grew up in a news culture where you think everything on MSNBC or Democracy Now or left-leaning news channel is complete but really, you have to take news stories, so-called news stories, one at a time and really unpack them and look at the definition of real news.
Each story, each time, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're a so-called left-leaning politically, you know, even Fox News is going to run a story that's going to be of interest and maybe accurate. For example, when they interviewed Julian Assange last election cycle in the fall from the Ecuadorian embassy outside of London, in which he gave sort of an extensive interview in which he talked about his own motivations and WikiLeaks motivations for releasing the 5,000 Podesta emails, et cetera. That was kind of a scoop for Fox, actually. It was kind of interesting. And no other national news source in the U.S., anyway, was willing to touch that. And, you know, of course, Fox was not huge Hillary Clinton fans and what have you. So they were happy to run the Julian Assange interview. But it was a really fascinating, I thought, incredible interview, whether you like Assange's politics or not. So that's an example.
So, Rob Williams, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, and we wanted to make sure we got to your addition to the Chomsky-Herman media filters from the propaganda model. And, of course, our listeners or listeners of this program know that it includes ownership and advertising as well as reliance on official sources as newsmakers, flack as well on negative criticism. There's also a built-in ideological kind of bias through capitalism and markets and so forth. But you have added five others that I think are very significant. And could you run through these briefly?
You named the first five. The sixth filter, and that is what I call the deep state disinformation filter. There's a lot to say about the deep state, but certainly we know that for decades now, the deep state, the Central Intelligence Agency, and other networked agencies within it have been massaging so-called U.S. news and information networks in all kinds of ways. So that's a sixth filter. The seventh filter is the algorithmic filter, in which these very powerful for-profit media corporations like Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon create and code these platforms. And these are designed, of course, to serve up information in ways that they deem best. The eighth filter is a term coined by MoveOn founder Eli Pariser called filter bubble. We digital media users, through our selective content and platform choices, determine the reality that surrounds us in the so-called filter bubble, and we need to sort of fight against that and push outside of the realm of our bubbles. I think that's really important. The ninth filter, wonderful phrase, behavioral micro-targeting. And this surfaced during the election last fall when we saw Cambridge Analytica, based in London, talk about massaging 221 million American voters with 5,000 pieces of individual data on each of them through a lot of these digital media platforms in the months and weeks prior to the election. It's hard to know how accurate and how much reach this organization has with behavioral micro-targeting, but suffice to say, I think it played more of a role in massaging electoral outcomes than people realize. So we need to look at that as a filter because it's pretty prevalent and it's coming on. And then finally, my favorite, the 10th filter is what we call sock puppets. And these are fake and often anonymous social media accounts that are unleashed into digital and social media spaces from corporations or governments designed to attack or support particular ideas, candidates, positions, platforms, campaigns. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the TV show Homeland, but there's a whole interesting subplot in the latest season of Homeland that had to do with the CIA and a secret sock puppet office that was kind of at work behind the scenes on social media, really trying to game the outcome. So those are the five new filters that we have proposed that we think about when we think about the propaganda model of news for the digital age.
Indeed, Rob Williams, and we agree, as you write, our best solution to fighting fake news and fomenting real news is an interdisciplinary one with the teaching of critical thinking, history, writing, and multimedia production at its core. And, of course, at Global Critical Media Literacy Project, Project Censored, ACME, so many of us in this community really working toward this. And, you know, now is really our time to shine, I think, Rob Williams. And now I believe our work is more important than ever, particularly given the last five filters that we are inundated with in this age of digital disorientation. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. We will certainly be revisiting these topics, and we'd love to have you back on the air to talk about them more specifically in the near future.
Mickey and Peter, thanks for your work, and we'll talk again soon.
After this brief musical break, we will return to the Project Censored Show in an interview with Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Welcome to the Holy City, a silver screen built with a lens and a low self-esteem. won't come back. We're selling the news. See, money speaks volumes louder than words. Or virtues with wings, maybe not quite at first. But salaries are paid by the ads, not the birds. We're selling the news. See, all men are equal, all is for sale. A powerful dog has been chasing his tail. The lowest common denominator prevails. We're selling the news. I wanna believe you, I wanna believe, but everything is in between. The fact is fiction, the fact is fiction. I wanna believe you, I wanna believe, but everything is in between. The fact is fiction. Suspicion is a new religion.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the program, we are going to continue our conversation, fighting fake news, media propaganda, and we're going to get more specific on some of these cases. We are very pleased to welcome back to the program journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and also with Media Roots. And we're going to hear more also about her recent dispatches from her trip to Venezuela. Abby Martin, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey and Peter. Great to be on.
So we were speaking with Rob Williams earlier in the program about the phenomenon of fake news and propaganda and the importance of critical media literacy education to deconstruct that, to understand more clearly and have people be able to consume news in a way that involves critical analysis. And as a journalist, for us at Project Censored, we think you epitomize what's best about journalistic principles because you do seek truth and you do go and shine light in dark places to tell the stories that others won't tell. And at the same time, you can't help but cast shadows on you call out fake news reports. And this doesn't mean you're using the term in the way that people like Donald Trump will use it as a weaponized term to shout down critics. But just because of the integrity of your work, you obviously make it problematic for corporate media narratives. And your most recent work in Venezuela is a classic example of how that's going on. So, Abby Martin, tell us about your latest work and what you've been learning and how that goes against the corporate narrative and State Department narrative we hear in the U.S. about Venezuela.
It's incredible, you guys. I mean, as a media analyst and critic for the last 10 years, you think that you've seen it all, right? You think that you know how to dissect propaganda when you kind of see it coming at your face, when it's coming just churning out ad nauseum, right, from all of these corporate media outlets, and not even corporate media outlets, a lot of leftist media outlets are echoing the same kind of regime change propaganda in regards to Venezuela. But wow, you really almost have to go on the ground to see just how egregious the lies and propaganda is. And I think it's probably the same with Syria. You know, you're embedded with these rebel fighters, and so you kind of apologize for Al-Qaeda, or you end up doing that. But when it comes to Venezuela, it seems like a lot of these outlets just echo the opposition's line and don't go on the ground and actually see for themselves what's going on and how nuanced the situation really is. So I'll talk about what we see. Of course, in the Western media, we see this repressive dictatorship, right, where Venezuela's becoming a totalitarian state, where Maduro's holding on to power. He's mowing down peaceful protesters in the street with these state forces. So, of course, the supermarkets are empty, you know, widespread starvation, people are breaking into zoos to eat the animals. So, of course, we go there expecting just complete and total chaos on the ground with all of these things to be true. And what we saw was actually the complete opposite. There is no widespread famine. Yes, people are eating less and worse now than in recent years because of an overarching economic war. A lot of people think that this is a socialist failure, right? Well, the economy is actually a trifold community, private, and state. So you look at where are the shortages coming from, how is this economic war being played out? Yes, you can't get toilet paper at some of these stores, but then you can get paper towels and napkins and Kleenex. So why is that? You start to realize that things aren't as they seem, that some of these companies have actually exacerbated the crisis by preventing loans. And a lot of these companies are working hand in hand with the opposition. So the economic war going on is very real. It's very strong. It's causing staple goods to be completely gone from the shelves, put in the black market. The companies claim that it's because the government is setting price controls that they can't sell these goods. So that's really the crux of the economic crisis. We talk to people in the street. We say, are you starving? You know, we see in the Western media that you guys are starving and begging on the streets and digging through trash. And they just say, no, that's completely untrue. There's an economic war going on in the media's line. When it comes to the protests, it's very curious as well, because the media completely obfuscates the class nature of these protests. It is completely black and white. The protests on the street are the upper middle class, wealthy people who can afford more food, right? But they use the poor cynically to say that we're starving, we need intervention. These people are the upper middle class people who kind of lost their power, their stronghold on the economy once Chavez got into power. As we know, Chavez and then Maduro, his successor, has won democratically. Jimmy Carter called them the most democratic elections in the world, about 17 elections straight. And so it wasn't until the opposition took power of one of the branches of government in 2015 that we started to see the economic crisis really exacerbate. And when you see this death toll being tossed around about the protests, there's, you know, 140 dead in the streets of Caracas, you realize that there are huge peaceful protests going on all the time from pro-government people, from pro-opposition people, but you see this death toll, and it's actually happening on the front lines of these things called the guarimbas. It's a sustained, violent blockade. We followed one around all night. They commandeered trucks. They lit burning barricades on the freeway. I mean, they're directly provoking these state forces. And, of course, altercations are going to happen when you're doing this day after day, throwing Molotov cocktails, planting explosives. The character of this protest movement is fascist and violent. They have burned people alive who are allegedly Chavista and black. This has happened plenty of times. Two people have already died from their burns, but they threatened to lynch me. They've threatened Global Vision journalists. They've doused them with gasoline. This is no joke. I can't think of another fascistoid characteristic of a political movement other than maybe the KKK or the neo-Nazis in Ukraine that use the tactic of burning alive political opponents. So it's a very serious situation, and unfortunately, everyone from Vice to CNN glorifies the hell out of these protesters and doesn't talk about what will happen. What will happen if the U.S. overthrows a democratically elected sovereign government and this opposition gets in power? What will happen? Will we see a Pinochet-style dictatorship, a mass privatization of all the Chavista programs? It's very scary that no one talks about the bigger picture here, guys.
Abby, thank you. It's clear that the corporate media continually labels the government as a dictatorship, which is absolute lie. It's completely false. There's been great elections there all along, and they just had an election for a constitutional assembly, which the right claims that they boycotted the election, but some 8 million people voted in this assembly, and they're trying to rewrite their constitution to make sure that the extreme right doesn't take power and ultimately control what's happening there. At the same time, the price of oil, of course, dropped, and that was manipulated by the Saudis and the U.S. globally. Venezuela was undermined in terms of their income from oil substantially, but they still have oil, and they're still selling that, and they're continuing in that capacity. So these are important understandings. Now, the supermarket story, the New York Times had a picture of an empty supermarket with a woman shopping there. And it was like a given, this is the supermarkets in Caracas. And you're saying that's false. I know that that's false. So it's really an amazing lie. But it's a lie orchestrated through the corporate media globally from the State Department and surely public relation firms and propaganda firms that work for the State Department and are putting out these lies. They're packaged them.
Yeah, so, and you know, we're talking about a movement that has tried to gain power through undemocratic means ever since Chavez took power. I mean, there was a U.S.-backed coup in 2002 where Chavez was kidnapped for 3 days. I mean, the opposition completely destroyed the Constitution when they got in power. They didn't bother with the nicety of trying to provide some feigned democratic leadership. They eviscerated it. And in 2014, we saw the same thing. I mean, they staged coups, coup after coup, violent uprising after violent uprising, where they're actually encouraging people to burn down buildings. Again, the protesters, as much as they use the starvation and famine as this tool to gain international sympathy, they are burning down food distribution warehouses. They just burned down a warehouse full of 50 tons of food, attacking maternity clinics, seizing hospitals and schools. So there is something very, very disturbing about the character of the protesters. And Peter, you mentioned the Constituent Assembly, and I think that's a really great point, because here you have the opposition boycotting it, right? A couple weeks prior, they had their own kind of fake referendum, which, of course, there were no ballots counted. You can count, you voted multiple times, as a Telesur undercover investigation showed. The media took that count at face value. 7 million people voted to boycott the Constituent Assembly. Yet they all boycotted the actual election several weeks later. And when you look at that outcome, 8 million people showed up. 8 million people. That is astounding. In a country of 30 million people, for 8 million people to come vote to support that process, right, to support this movement, this Chavista movement that is alive and well and cannot be ruled without this vision incorporated. And that's what the opposition wants to do. It's a fascist vision where they want to rule without Chavismo, without taking the poor in account, with a mass privatization. And that's exactly what the Constituent Assembly was doing. It was supposed to protect the missions, these dozens of missions that have been employed, free healthcare, free education, free housing. They want to protect these things because they are very worried, again, what will happen if the opposition takes power, because it could be very, very ugly, and they know that they need to mobilize to show their strength. And unfortunately, you have the media here just calling it a fraud, you know, calling it a lie. It's absolutely absurd. Every election that they have, you can audit the vote. They have paper ballots. It's way more transparent than the U.S.
Yeah, indeed it is. But you're also describing a similar problem with the U.S. regarding the press and the control of information and propaganda that is seemingly quite pervasive there.
Oh, my God. That's another thing we hear, right? Maduro controls all the press. Maduro jails all political opponents, shuts down all these media outlets that are critical of him. Look, yes, a media outlet, their license wasn't renewed because they were calling to kill the president during one
right.
of the coup attempts 10 years prior. Okay, let's look at the newspapers. I went around Caracas and bought up 10 different newspapers. What was the breakdown? Actually, it was way more diverse than the United States. As we know, the corporate media essentially just echoes state propaganda. It might as well be state media. In Caracas, 8 out of the 10 papers were extremely critical of Maduro. One even said Trump must take care of Maduro. Another one showed Vladimir Padrino, the defense minister, saying the blood is on your hands of all the protesters. Can you imagine? Even police officers that kill black people with total impunity here, can you imagine blaming Trump for that and saying the blood is on your hands, Trump, for all the black unarmed men who were killed by police? So the narrative is very different, and it's the same actually on TV when you break down the Nielsen rating and the amount that is captured in terms of the audience of state versus private media. You're looking at only about 9% audience tuning into state media on TV. So it is a gross exaggeration. And really, we hear that time and again. You know, the countries that they claim, that the Western media claims has no free press, usually has hugely free press.
Certainly relative to the United States that operates under the illusion of a free press. And, of course, Mark Crispin Miller called that out with aerial quotes in the foreword to our last book, Our Free Press. Well, Abby Martin, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with the program Empire Files and a little bit more about what you have in store for people and where they get more information.
So we did a huge series on Palestine. We did this series on Venezuela, really the hot spots where I feel like the media is completely failing and working on behalf of the U.S. empire. And I'm talking about leftist alternative media as well, really failing on this issue on Venezuela. So we really wanted to provide that nuance, the complexities to that, and really break through the disinformation. And that's what this show really is. Not only is it breaking through the propaganda and disinformation about these issues, you know, the catastrophic wars on multiple fronts that the U.S. empire is facing and Trump is exacerbating, turbocharging the empire, but it's also providing that voice, right, to the marginalized and oppressed people who haven't been able to write history themselves. History has been written by the winners, and we're retelling these lost chapters of American history and things that have happened today to put in the perspective of empire and how it's shaped the world and really bring out these voices of resistance that have been completely censored throughout the years. So it's a beautiful project, and we're completely independent. It's really amazing to just have complete editorial freedom and produce whatever we want. We're actually going to Houston 1 month later when all the media vultures and parasites are gone out of people's faces and really analyzing what happened and what needs to be done a month later after the dust settles. So we're looking forward to that coverage, and everyone can check it out on theempirefiles.tv.
What's the website again, Abby?
Theempirefiles.tv. Okay. And mediaroots.org.
So, Abby, in the United States, we've seen a strange brew here this past year with the labeling of fake news and how the term has been weaponized by Trump. But it's strange because it really works as a distraction away from the problem we have in the corporate state media here and corporate slash state, a State Department press release or PR industry that controls news here. there really is a fake news problem here. And it's not just satire, and it's not just a weaponized term. It's the fact that we do lack diversity in our media, and we do have hegemonic narratives in the corporate media here, and even in alternative media outlets, including the left media, we lack significant diversity and openness of discussion. But it's that weaponization of the term. And if you go back in history, like the Lügenpresse, right, back in Germany, World War I, World War II, where it's the lying press was a weaponized phrase. So, you know, this is not new. And if we want to really look at real fake news, perhaps we should be looking at CIA involvement in media and deep state involvement. I know that term's been run through the ringer this past year, but going back and looking at media control, given your experience and certainly the narratives that you write about, what are your views on this conundrum that we find ourselves?
Well, it's quite a conundrum, Mickey, because as you just mentioned, the president has weaponized the term to now just have his base of neo-fascists trust only the news that worships him, right? And this kind of crazy propagandistic Breitbart-style Drudge Report aggregation that just exacerbates racial tensions and horrible, horrible sentiment against minorities. So that's one thing, extremely dangerous, right? And I see people every day sharing literal fake news stories from your newswire.com, et cetera, just making stuff up about Trump. They all live in a tiny echo chamber. But your point is very well made about the larger problem of fake news. I mean, how do we get into every war that we've gotten into? New York Times, the purveyor of fake news. Washington Post, the purveyor of fake news. I mean, these are supposed papers of the Beltway, right? The paper of record, setting the news of the state. And unfortunately, they lie time and again, exaggerate time and again. Look at Judith Miller. How does she still have a job? This woman should be shamed. She should be in jail. She has the blood of a million Iraqis on her hand. The fact that these people are paraded on the media, David Frum, Eric Prince, given an op-ed in the New York Times talking about how we need to privatize the war in Afghanistan. It's already privatized. So, yes, it's amazing and astounding when you see publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post trying to say what is and what is not fake news. And then when you look at the nitty-gritty, what they're trying to call fake news is essentially all non-corporate funded media. So really, it all goes down in the attack on leftist, grassroots, alternative media, the organizations that are doing the real work, right? Project Censored, Truth Dig, Counterpunch. And it is a very concerted effort. There's even a new think tank, the PNAC 3.0, coming up that really is only focusing on fake news. You see the attack on RT. It wasn't necessarily about hacking the election. It was about putting out contradictory news that they don't want to put out there.
And you also were to blame somehow, even though you hadn't had a show there for years.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the DNI report because it shows you exactly what they're most scared of. They're most scared of real reporting and real truth-telling. And that's what this new think tank is about discrediting organizations like RT and organizations that get out information that they do not want people to know. And when half the country is living in poverty, I think it's damn right they're right to know.
And indeed, you know, Trump ran a campaign as a war on the press, shouting, lock them up as journalists. And then he weaponized fake news, taking it out of the mouths of the DNC, per se. And then also that kind of hostility to the press went all the way up to the House race in Montana with Greg Gianforte beating up a Guardian reporter, Ben Jacobs, literally because he didn't want to answer his questions and, in fact, pleaded guilty to even doing this. Of course, he was seated as representative in Montana anyway, because this apparently is the United States where we don't have a free press. But at any rate, you know, just on a concluding point, it's clear that Trump and his supporters don't care about journalism or a free press, you know, or for that matter, an informed populace in a democratic republic. And all these histrionics, they're hard to keep up with all the tweeting and things. These really illustrate that it's long past time to insist that we have a robust and critical free press. We exercise it, one that actually fights back, not with snide antics and playground politics where CNN kind of gets into a fist fight and gets into the wrestling ring with Trump, but with actual real investigative reporting that holds the administration accountable for policies and actions, not personality politics, not reality TV, right? And that's, of course, what we see here in the United States, and that's why the corporate press is failing. Ever more time for independent, viable press like yours, Abby Martin, and the Empire File. So we can't thank you enough for the great work that you do.
Thank you so much, you guys. You guys rock.
Thank you so much, Abby. We will definitely be catching up with you in the near future. Coming up after this musical break, we'll speak with the Associate Director of Project Censor, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about the newest book we put together from Project Censored called Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News.
try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land. You know, John Paul Getty is just plain folks. The UN Charter is a cruel hoax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. J. Edgar Hoover is the man of the hour. All that he needs is just a little more power. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today's show, we've been focusing on all things media. We've been talking about the propaganda model in a digital age. Of course, we heard from Rob Williams. We've also heard from Abby Martin and discussed her program, The Empire Files, and the importance of a free press in our times. We're now joined by Associate Director of Project Censored, my partner in crime in the Censored Annual Books published by Seven Stories Press. We're joined by Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy is co-editor with me of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's so great to be on the air with you, Mickey.
Indeed. And Andy, of course, you've co-hosted with us and you've been on the show a number of times. And here we are again, another year. And yes, it is another book from Project Censored. And why don't you tell listeners briefly a little bit about this year's book that's coming out on October 3rd?
Well, as you've mentioned, Mickey, the subtitle of the book is Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. And so one of the major themes of the book that runs across all the way from Deepa Kumar's foreword through our introduction and through a number of the substantive chapters is this idea of what does it mean to say we live in a post-truth world? The Oxford dictionaries defined post-truth as describing circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So what does it mean to talk about the role of journalism and the importance of press freedoms in a world that for many people is defined by this condition of being, quote, post-truth? And part of the argument that I think runs as a thread throughout the book, and the reason we put post-truth in quotations, is that we at Project Censored are not ready to accept that condition as a given, as the new normal, and so forth, that we're pushing back against that idea, as are the many contributors to this year's volume.
Indeed, Andy, that is true. And you mentioned Deepa Kumar, who's at Rutgers, a scholar, author. We've worked with Deepa Kumar before, and this year she graced our book with a fabulous foreword that really begins the Censored 2018 book talking about the Oxford Dictionary post-truth phenomenon and conundrum, and also riffs on another favorite theme of ours, that of the importance of academic freedom and the importance for all subjects to be addressed, to be taught without impunity. And certainly this year's book, Censored 2018, addresses those in the top 25 through the news abuse chapters. Also this year, you and I have an addition that was not in any of the previous books. We have a graphic chapter. Do you want to talk to listeners a little bit about that or some of the other contents here?
The graphic chapter that we have, we've been working for several years to have a chapter in that format as part of the annual yearbook, and we succeeded this year. A fantastic piece with the text by Adam Bessie out at Diablo Valley College and illustrations by Peter Glanting. And of course, we're on the radio now, so we can't show you imagery, but it's possible to talk about some of the influences and some of the name checks in this Trump universe chapter. They draw on the visual vocabulary of Jack Kirby's Galacticus and Doctor Doom. They're invoking Ursula Le Guin and name checking Rod Serling's Twilight Zone and George Orwell's 1984. But all of this, without stealing the thunder of this really moving chapter, is, although it may seem like the Trump universe is a Twilight Zone science fiction type of universe, their argument is that the story is one that can undergo a massive rewrite. And their whole graphic chapter is in some ways a call for us to engage in that significant revision of the storyline.
Indeed, it is. And again, we invite listeners to go to our website, projectcensored.org. Not only are all of our archives there from the radio for nearly 7 years, but our top stories dating back to our founding year in 1976. Our guest is Andy Lee Roth, the associate director of Project Censored, and also the co-editor here of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. Andy Roth, since we were just riffing on images, tell us a little bit about the cover of this year's book. In the intro, we write about Umberto Eco: a democratic civilization will save itself only if it makes the language of the image into a stimulus for critical reflection, not an invitation for hypnosis.
Right. So, yeah, and when Umberto Eco wrote that back in 1979, he was thinking of television screens. But, of course, now we carry small-scale screens with us all the time, and we interface with images nearly 24/7 through our various tablets and handheld devices, which brings to relevance the image that is the cover of our book this year. We're so lucky to have worked again with Hillary Allison, who did the cover for the Censored 2016 book. And this year she's given us an image that I think is so powerful and contemporary. The scene is a living room. On the screen of the big screen TV in the living room is a raging fire. On the mantelpiece above the screen showing the fire, there are no fewer than 3 fire extinguishers. And so the imagery I have is of a household that has followed the agenda set by the media as broadcast across their TV. Fire is danger. Fire is a danger. But the image, as Hillary Allison has created it, is one of the living room is actually being flooded. So the danger coming to us over the screen is of one element, fire, and the preparation has been made appropriately for that particular threat. But the real actual danger is another element, water, in the form of flooding. So we talked in our introduction about the richness of this image, and just to pick up one dimension of that, of course it was Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 that featured this idea of the public being distracted from impending war by the wall-sized screens that bombarded them with nonsense. And in this case, I think Hillary Allison's imagery resonates with that notion from Bradbury's classic. But the danger of fire in the circumstances of global warming is a real one. It's not that the screen is broadcasting nonsense. It's that the screen is setting an agenda or misdirecting the public's attention from what's really going on. And, of course, that's a theme that resonates with this idea of, well, do we live in a post-truth world? If it is a post-truth world, how should we best respond, and so forth.
Indeed, and we do respond with the top 25 stories, and certainly in the introduction where we riff around a great quote from the Indian writer Rabindranath Tagore that is, truth comes as a conqueror only because we have lost the art of receiving it as guest, to riff on the post-truth theme. So, Andy Roth, we have about 2 minutes left here in the segment. Could you give our listeners a couple teasers maybe about some of the other things that are in Censored 2018?
Well, you know, one of the things, I don't want to give away too much about this year's top 25 list, except maybe to just tease this one out a little bit. In a period of time going back to the 2016 elections, where we've been inundated by politicians, pundits, and the like about fake news this and fake news that, one of the top stories that we've been tracking this past year and that will feature in this year's top 25 list, a story originally reported by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism out of the UK, out of London, is that the Pentagon paid a UK PR firm millions of dollars over a period of years to produce and distribute fake Al-Qaeda videos. So without going into the details of that story, which will be featuring much more prominently in the upcoming weeks as the book is released, in a year when pundits and politicians of all stripes across the political spectrum, as well as members of the public and the establishment press, were crowing over fake news, this is one of the stories that went completely underreported, unacknowledged in the U.S. corporate media. And it's only because of independent investigative journalistic outlets like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism that we know about how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, secretly used taxpayer money to create fake news of its own.
Indeed, and that is a very powerful story and statement, and there are many, many other similar themes and stories in Censored 2018 out by Seven Stories Press October 3rd, so get your copy when you can. And the rest of the book, of course, we have Media Democracy in Action with our friends at the Index on Censorship and Tribeworthy and others, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have our colleagues Nolan Higdon, Nicholas Baham III on the New American Authoritarianism and Normalized Racism. Elizabeth Blakey has a fabulous chapter on defamation as censorship in the social media era. We also have some really heavy hitters, Edward Herman from the Propaganda Model fame, Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model Authority, and Ralph Nader talks about breaking through power and the mass media blackout of his Super Bowl of Citizen Action. So it's a chock-full book, Censored 2018. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, co-editor with me of Censored 2018. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Mickey.
That was a conversation with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. I'm Mickey Huff, and the book that Andy and I were just talking about is our latest from Seven Stories Press. It's Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. These are the top censored stories and media analysis for the years 2016 and 17. Noam Chomsky has said of Project Censored's work, it's a crucial contribution to the hope for a more just and democratic society. Did you know that over 1,000 communities in the United States are experiencing lead contamination at quadruple the rates found in Flint, Michigan? Or that the U.S. Army has accumulated $6.5 trillion in expenditures that cannot be accounted for? What about the racially biased software used by judges to predict future crimes? Or the fossil fuel industry's influence over environmental research? Haven't heard the news? Well, neither did the rest of the world, and that's because these and countless other news items are suppressed or ignored by our nation's so-called free press every day. For the past 42 years, Project Censored has been unearthing the buried stories that corporate media deem unfit to print, and debunking the fake news governments and corporations use to consolidate their power to promote well-informed citizen action and critical media literacy. This year's book, Censored 2018, features The New American Authoritarianism by Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III, whom you recognize from being associate co-hosts of the Project Censored show and podcast. We also have a fantastic graphic chapter this year by Diablo Valley College English professor Adam Bessie, a colleague of mine, and artist Peter Glanting. It's called The Trump Universe, and it is a fantastic look at this dystopic imagery and language that we see being used around the Trump presidency. We also this year have a fantastic chapter by Elizabeth Blakey, Defamation as Censorship in the Social Media Era. This is a great chapter that talks about who has standing, who has First Amendment standing, who counts as a media defendant. We also are delighted to have Edward Herman from Herman and Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent fame. Edward Herman did a chapter for us called Still Manufacturing Consent, The Propaganda Model at 30. And Ralph Nader rounds out Censored 2018 with Breaking Through Power. He talks about how his events in Washington, D.C. were the subject of a media blackout, even though it was a Super Bowl of citizen action. All of that and more in Censored 2018, the top censored stories of the past year, junk food news, news abuse, and media democracy in action. And again, that is a great way for us to kind of finalize today's show, which was based on media literacy, critical media literacy, and the fights against censorship. Again, I'm Mickey Huff, and this is the Project Censored show. I'm just going to tell you a few other things that you can find in the pages of Censored 2018. Again, there's a lot of contents in Censored 2018 that you'll likely hear over the course of the next several months, as we'll be interviewing the people, the intrepid journalists, the independent press, who have covered the important stories that we need to know about. And not only are they in the book and online and published originally, of course, at the outlets where they write and work, we, of course, link all of the original articles and urge you to support these kind of independent outlets. Again, Censored 2018, Andy Lee Roth, myself, Mickey Huff with Project Censored are the editors. We have a fantastic foreword by Deepa Kumar, the scholar from Rutgers University who writes on Islamophobia. Khalil Bendib, once again, has fantastic cartoons that add to the book. And just, again, a couple more teasers for you to go out and pick up a copy of this. We have stories on big data and dark money behind the 2016 election that have a lot more to do with the outcome than so-called fake news. We have another story on voter suppression. Again, far more likely that this has to do with the outcome of the election along with the Electoral College than fake news. A blockbuster story on Pentagon-paid United Kingdom public relations firms making fake Al-Qaeda videos. The Pentagon paid a UK PR firm to make fake Al-Qaeda videos talking about fake news. We also have record year of global internet shutdowns. We also have Shell Oil understanding that climate change was a problem with their industry as early as 1991, and they chose to ignore it. And we also have some good news stories about how young plaintiffs invoke constitutional grounds for climate protection. So these, again, are fantastic stories in the book. 8 use of force policies to prevent killings by police. So again, there's a lot going on in the book, including Media Democracy for Action with our friends at Tribeworthy. Also some pieces by Kevin Gastolia and Rana Kalik at Unauthorized Disclosure, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Rachel Jolly and the Index on Censorship. Again, Censor 2018, out now, 7 Stories Press. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Peter and I are executive producers and co-hosts. Anthony Fest, our producer. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. To learn more about the Project Censored Show and our parent nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, go to projectcensored.org. To hear our past programs and special Project Censored podcasts with our associate hosts Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, and Desiree McSwain, go to projectcensored.org/radio. Click on our podcast on our Patreon page. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times where the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in our